Welcome to another episode of Conversations About Running, the podcast by Running Trips. We are the people behind Kenya Experience and Training Focus Camps. In today's podcast, we are joined by Great Britain athlete Callum Elson. Callum is a 1500 meter specialist with a PB of 3:35, who tasted his first global success at the inaugural World Road Running Championships in Riga in October of last year. In a dramatic sprint for the line, Callum took the silver medal in the mile road race behind American Hobbs Kessler. Callum has enjoyed a spectacular rise up the ranks of British middle distance running in the past few years, and until recently had his sights set firmly on attaining an Olympic qualifying spot in what is one of Team GB's strongest events. Following his race in Riga, Callum went on to qualify for his first GB vest on the track at this winter's World Indoor Championships in Glasgow, where disaster struck in the heats as Callum was spiked through his Achilles tendon by a fellow competitor. His Olympic dream instantly in tatters, Callum is now embarking on the long and difficult process of rehabbing a partially torn Achilles tendon and is already looking ahead to the 2025 season. Callum's rise to the top table of domestic 1500 metre running has been achieved partially through a unique approach to social media and content creation, utilising his skills and resources online to help further his athletic career. Both the injury and his approach to social media and YouTube are subjects that we go into in detail on this podcast. Callum and I thoroughly enjoyed our time talking to Callum, and we hope that you also enjoy this episode of Conversations About Running with Callum Elson. Right, welcome to another episode. Today we are joined by Callum Elson. Callum, thank you very much.
How are you doing, lads? Good to meet you both. And
Have the two Callums, have you two not met before?
I think we've crossed paths, but not
races and various things. But when you're caught up with other stuff, it's like, oh, just a passing, like, oh, hello, how you doing? Recognize faces, etc. To sit down and chat with you both.
Yeah, good. I reached out to him fairly recently saying, mate, we need to get you in On Gear. And he showed up here in Hoka gear. So I'm guessing we're a bit late to the party.
Yeah, I mean, On, man, like, I don't know if you know how well you know Jordan Donnelly, but great, great guy, Jordan. I had a few conversations with him. And to be honest, like, it was something I was really exploring. And then, yeah, other things came up and I'm a taken man now.
So on that note, I mean, so generally speaking, I think our audience are fairly educated in sort of serious running. But let's assume people haven't got a clue who you are. So let's rewind a little bit. Say, Callum, can you just give us a little bit then of who are you kind of as an athlete and what's your sort of current situation?
Yeah, definitely. I won't bore you with the long story of how I got into running and all that sort of stuff. There's a million things out there. But predominantly a middle distance athlete. I'm based in Cambridge at the moment, run for Cambridge and Coleridge. I'm originally from Leeds. 1500, 5K has been kind of the focus of my training of the last couple of years, simply because that's where I've found that my ability kind of, I can do the most, essentially get further, try and qualify for teams and run fast times and stuff like that. But still done quite a bit on the cross country side of things, 10, 12K cross country, all the kind of, big races in the British calendar from that perspective. So yeah, I was on a good trajectory of sorts. I was kind of like training, racing, doing more, kept qualifying for new things, running, you know, good times and PBs. And then a couple of months ago, literally, I think probably 8 weeks ago from now, I got my first kind of major injury, you could say. I partially tore my Achilles during a race, which was, yeah, unfortunate. So that set me out for a long time in terms of like the recovery and then eventually getting back to racing even longer. So I'm at a kind of a crossroads now between everything was going well and I've done all that kind of like, you know, happy clappy, everything, sunshine and rainbows. And now it's like, okay, more of a test of, can you dig in? Can you get over an injury? Can you be a bit smarter with training? All these different things. So it's a strange time at the moment.
So you say be a bit smarter with training, but this was you mean in terms of getting back? Because this was a freak accident, wasn't it? Rather than
In terms of getting back, what I mean by that is like, I've got quite far with my natural talent. And obviously I'm not underplaying like the fact you've got to be disciplined. I've got a great coach and do my training, like all of that stuff. But in terms of problem solving, the most problem solving we've had to do is, okay, I'm not quite running this time I want to run, or I'm a little bit weak in this area. So what training can we do in order to get better at that? Whereas now the challenge is far bigger. It's not how can we run a second quicker per lap. It's like, okay, how are we going to go gradually, but also as efficiently as possible, from you're in a boot and you can't do any running for, you know, 6 months to run, walk, eventually running, and then hopefully representing GB and getting back to a world level, it's going to take a lot of kind of thinking, clever training, leaning on maybe sports science a little bit more than I previously had and all those sorts of things. So yeah, that's what I mean in terms of like smartening up and needing to be a little bit kind of professional about things.
So aside from like being in an actual boot and having like, you know, going to doctors and things, do you have like a team around you who are helping with that side of things, or is it literally just you and your coach?
Yeah, so my coach is based in the States, so we do everything remotely and just like chat on the phone and stuff. So he plans all my training. So at the moment, that's kind of cross training, and that's all led essentially by like the specialist, by the surgeon, in terms of what load I can pretty much take. I.e., at the moment, we're kind of just like working off an hour a day as a rough example of like, okay, that's a manageable amount that you can do. So my coach still plans in all the training and what the sessions look like on the bike and working to heart rate, things like that. And then I'm on a scheme called TAS, which I don't know if listeners know about. It's called Talented Athlete Support Scheme or Support. I don't know exactly what it's called, but it's like a government funded thing. It's not just for athletics. It's for all sorts of sports. And luckily I got accepted onto that scheme through England Athletics in October, November time. So it came at a perfect time. And through that, you can access a certain amount of private medical. So that was how I was able to get surgery kind of within 2 weeks of doing the injury, have your MRIs covered, have your physio covered, stuff like that. So yeah, not exactly like a team in terms of like, you know, exclusive people that I work with, but in terms of having the necessary support to be able to, you know, get the help I need, definitely. It's like, you know, I can't have really asked for any more in that department. So yeah, I'm not just guessing with what to do. It is being led by, you know, people that know what they're on about, hopefully.
So assuming, I'm going to rewind and ask a sort of a precursor question as well before this, but assuming you hadn't have got onto that TAS program, how different, and would it have been quite a serious situation? Would the situation have been coming off the back of that injury? Like if that support wasn't in place, would that have presented you with some pretty serious issues?
I don't know. For me, my girlfriend might say different. We're in the process at the moment of like looking to buy for the first time. So we have a good amount of savings and stuff behind us. So in terms of would I have wanted to pay for all the private medical and the things like that? Absolutely not. And would it have been kind of a horrible moment being like, shit, I'm left with this big bill? Like, yes, it would have been frustrating, but would I have done it? Yes, 100%. And would I have gone the same way in terms of the specialist that they recommend, even if it was more expensive or whatever? I still definitely would have done it, simply because, well, from a financial perspective, I think that if I can get back to the level and, you know, get a contract extension and stuff like that, hopefully it'll get paid back anyway in terms of like what I would have to put out of my own pocket. But then also from like a love of the sport and like personal endeavor point of view, you know, I don't go out drinking all the time and smoking and doing whatever. I'm kind of like, if I've got money to spend, I may as well spend it to do with running and trying to like better myself in that way. So yeah, the main issue wouldn't have been could I have got the support. It would have been the stress that came with it. So as soon as I knew kind of from British Athletics at the start, okay, while you're away with Team GB, you're getting everything covered. So like I could go to the MRI straight away. All the physio while I'm away with the team is covered. They told me that straight away because they knew I'd be concerned. So that was great. And then when I got home, there was a couple of days where I had to go back and forth on emails with kind of TAS and insurance and stuff and say, look, like, where do I sit with this? Where I was kind of trying to prepare myself to be like, okay, if they come back and say it's going to be, I don't even know how much it would be, if they're going to say it's $5,000 or whatever it is to get something done, being prepared to have that. But equally, they came back so quickly and were like, yeah, we'll be able to, you know, at least subsidize it, if not fully cover it. It removed the stress element and I could just focus on what I need to do to recover. So yeah, it's not something that I take lightly, to be fair, because there's some seriously good athletes that through the politics of the situation of the system don't meet certain criteria that mean they don't get on this specialist kind of funding thing. So, you know, I'm just lucky that for the next year or 2 years, however long it is, I'm on that system.
So basically the only difference is you would have had to explain to your girlfriend that you're not buying a house yet because you've got an Achilles to sort out.
Yeah, or I would have had to say, I'm not going to be running for 9 months, so I'll earn some more money in that 9 months and sell my soul to the brand world, and you'll see me on Instagram with some sort of like random brand deals.
You're not with Pure Sport yet. They're the big ones, aren't they?
I don't know who pays the most, honestly. I think if you want to earn the most, it'll be some really rogue one, honestly. It'll be like some sort of something that you won't even imagine that you'd endorse, I bet, is where they've got crazy money.
Be like Toyota or something like that, Mercedes.
Yeah, yeah, something random, yeah.
Is that where you feel British middle distance running is currently at? Like Mercedes are going to be knocking at the door for sponsorship deals.
I don't know if we can say British middle distance running, but Josh Kerr, I don't think any of us would be surprised, would we, if we saw him doing a Mercedes advert?
Yeah.
I think it would honestly fit perfect with him. Other people, yeah, you know, if you see Adam Fogg in a Mercedes, I think we'll be, you know, we'll be wondering what's going on, but you could see Josh doing it, definitely.
So can we, at some point, I'd like to rewind a little bit and just and give people a little bit more information on the specifics of what happened to you. And then follow through with kind of what that process has looked like then in terms of the recovery. But yeah, then what I said I was going to have the little sort of precursor questions. What I said was that my next door neighbor is part of the medical team who was looking after you in Glasgow. I remember asking him straight away. Like, I mean, he's a soft tissue therapist, so he probably wasn't top of the pile when you got a serious Achilles injury, but I just remember saying to him the day after he got back, I was like, is Callum going to get looked after? Like the fact that you're there with British, the fact that it happens essentially whilst you were on international duty, does that mean that you are then covered through that? And I just remember the look on his face, like when I asked him, and he just went, it's not going to be covered. And then I remember him saying at the time, I think he's on England Athletics. So he kind of had an idea that you were going to be all right. But to me, it just seemed mental. It's like, imagine if a footballer's off playing for England, get injured on the pitch, and then they're like, well, yeah, we'll keep looking after you until we like get back to the coach to go home. But then at that point, you're kind of on your own. It's a little bit scary, to be honest, to think that someone can be at that level of the sport and still not really be looked after.
Yeah, it is a weird one. Like, one thing I should definitely say is I've always been the person that from the outside has been critical of like team sizes with GB and being like, oh, why is there so many more staff than there is athletes and whatever. Like, I've always said funding needs to go more to getting athletes to events, all that sort of stuff. But from a completely selfish point of view, when it's you in that situation and you're the one that's got the injury, having all of those people there to be able to support you and like, you know, enough physios that a couple of them have to go down to the track for the events that's still going on and you're in the hotel, you know, and you need some painkillers or whatever it is, like, having the British Athletic staff around was a massive help. And while you're away, the treatment was absolutely fantastic. So like, you know, I can't criticize anything in terms of what I received when I was there. But yeah, the wider question of duty of care, and I don't know how much I should or like maybe can say, but I know there's like a, I don't know if they're called like the athlete commission, or there's basically some like athlete board basically that liaises between what athletes want and what like the governing body should do. And I know it's something that they're looking into at the moment in terms of the wider question of duty of care of athletes. And when does that stop? If you are competing for Great Britain or you're within the system and something happens to you, whether it be like a mental health thing or a physical thing, at what point do kind of British Athletics, their kind of duty of care stop and you get help elsewhere? Or how do they transition you over to make sure you're getting adequate support? So yeah, even though I didn't meet the criteria at the moment on British Athletics funding in order to access certain kind of things, I must say that the referrals they gave me in terms of like, I'm not on funding, but like the Dr. James Brown, who I think he's like the lead doctor, will still drop me a WhatsApp to see how the things are going. He liaises directly with the surgeon that kind of did my surgery and stuff like that. And I get emails from certain team members that were at the event to check in how I'm doing. So it's not a case that the individuals in question are like horrible and just like forget about you. I think it's more the policy and like the framework that they've got is potentially flawed in terms of, you know, like, luckily it was just me that left there with a bad injury. But you think if it was maybe more of a, you know, someone who was nailed on for Paris, for example, the treatment of them, how would that be different? What would that care look like? I think, you know, it really does depend whether you, in a certain, whether you've ticked a certain box to say we will fund you this year or not, is the difference between whether you're going to get potential career-changing surgery, etc.
There are levels of British Athletics funding, right? And is one of those levels not funding, but like support?
Not that I know of. I don't actually know how it works. Again, like, I'm so relatively new to the sport and I'm so on the outside where like I'm only just developing connections of like meeting other athletes that already run for GB or like knowing who certain staff members are that do things. And this was my first vest on the track. And the people who look after the track team are similar to the people that look after cross country and stuff like that. But it is slightly different in terms of who's in those senior positions. So again, I don't have a direct line to a lot of people to say, how does this work? Or what criteria do I need to meet this year? Or, you know, probably for the best, there's not a system where you can put your hand up and say, well, this person's getting funding and they've only achieved X, Y, and Z. I've done this, maybe I should get it. And, you know, it would lead to a whole load of other issues, wouldn't it, in that sense? So yeah, I think there is an argument to say, and I don't know exactly what I would do if I was in charge, but there's an argument to say that you could take some of the funding that's given to athletes in terms of a monetary value. And if you were to separate that out into a wider budget as almost like a fund that supports you just with resources, how much further could it go and how many more athletes could you potentially help? Now, I don't know what the budgets look like, so I don't have a clue, but I would imagine you could help more people if you funded physical things like physio, hospital treatment, access to certain resources, than if you just gave them cash and said, here's our thing, like, hopefully you'll use it for the best, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, but I guess at some point that kind of paves the way into like a professional career as well, because it's like almost bridging the gap between getting full-on like brand support and just a bit of money so that you can focus on, you know, doing athletics as a job, because there's not always like an immediate pathway into becoming a full-time professional athlete. So yeah,
I think I
see. Yeah, go on.
Sorry, so I think with Callum specifically, this is probably a route we want to go down and have a proper chat about, because obviously Callum's got his own unique approach to sort of self-funding, essentially. I'd like to, if we can, I'd like to just stick on here and now for a few more minutes, if we can. I don't know if this is the direction you were taking it, Cal, which I think is a great thing to do. But I do just want to touch on a little bit more on the specific injury and where you are with your rehab and where you are with the, if you don't mind, before we then delve into, I think, what Callum was going to, sorry, it's going to get confusing me saying Callum does this, Callum does that. yeah, I presume I know where Callum was going, but before we head in that direction, can we get an update on, has the surgery been a success as far as you know? And then what are the sort of intermediary and longer term targets coming back from that now? Is the summer been written off, or is that still in the back of your mind that you might get on track and race?
Yeah. So, I mean, to answer the last question first, the summer's definitely written off, like 100%. If I can like jog a little bit by the time the last track meet's done, then that would be like success, I think. From a has the surgery work point of view, again, I check in. So I had surgery on the 16th of March, had a cast on for 2 weeks, and then got that change into a boot. And that was the last time that I saw the surgeon to kind of, you know, he was happy with how things looked, how the wounds were. The like initial kind of observations he could make was like, yeah, done a good job, like should be fine. But obviously in that time,
patting himself on the back. Yeah, I've done well here.
Yeah, literally, yeah. But obviously the muscle wastage is so much around your calf, and the nature of a Achilles tendon injury is, or the new kind of thinking they've got behind it, is the longer they keep you in flexion, so essentially like the shorter the tendon is at the time, and i.e. like the bits that have broken, if you keep them, you sew them back together and then you keep them touching for as long as possible, the better the healing will be in the long term. So traditionally you would be in a boot where you would have like a big wedge under your heel, so you'd essentially, as if you've got like high heels on or something like that. And then every couple of weeks or however often, one of those wedges would be removed and you gradually get lower to your foot being 90 degrees, aka like just wearing a shoe and it being flat. What he wants to do with me is for the full 8 weeks that I'm in the boot, keep it at the highest possible point. So keep it in that full flexion in the hope that the healing will be kind of stronger so I can get back to super explosive movements, running 1500 meters, not just recovering to walk, right? Recovering to like be an elite athlete. So I'm at week 5. Now, I think since in, am I at week 5? Week 5 since my surgery, I think. Yeah, so I'll have a check-in this week coming with the surgeon where hopefully, again, I'll assess things, just monitor things. I'll have another 4 weeks before I then get back into a shoe. And from that point is only really where you can start the real specific rehab of like gradually loading the tendon. And it's all just about getting as much load through it as possible, building it up stronger, building all the calf muscles around it in order to be able to support it properly. And there's a lot of that you have to do before you can consider getting back to running, run, walk, like all that sort of stuff. So realistic timeline is probably September to be back running. So it's like a 6-month injury pretty much since I actually did it in order to get back running. And then in my head, if I can race at the start of next year, maybe, like, that would be good. But I'm really not even putting any pressure on, like, getting back to racing. It's kind of like, I don't know how I'll mentally and physically be at that point anyway. So really, I think I just want to get back running, gradually build up, do some stuff. And then once I'm in a position where I can feel confident enough that my Achilles is not going to, you know, go pop or anything like that, then start looking at what some races might look like. So, yeah, it's a bloody long time. It's annoying. Like, you literally may as well have, like, broken your leg. Do you know what I mean? Like, the bone would heal quicker than it would take it with this injury. It's just such an annoying injury.
So did they have to... They've had to stitch the Achilles back to itself, or have they had to kind of stitch attachments back together?
No, so I didn't have to have any tendon graft. So that was one thing, because of the nature of the fact that I didn't have an Achilles rupture, which is, like, traditionally what they would treat. So, like, high jumpers and things like that, like, they often rupture their Achilles. Because mine, I got spiked into the Achilles from the runner that was behind me. And then I continued to take some steps after it, because obviously in the race, you don't know what's happened. Mm. You've got momentum, stuff like that. They didn't know what, and they couldn't tell from MRI, what that would look like inside my leg. So when I went into the surgery, he said, look, we're going to try and do, like, a minimally invasive procedure like they normally do. Just cut a small, about 1 centimeter, 1.5 centimeter hole, do whatever science stuff they need to do to fix your leg. But he did say...
That's what it is, science stuff.
Exactly, there you go. And then he said the other thing they might have to do is a far bigger incision where it's, like, say, 4 or 5 centimeters. And then also potentially harvest tendons, like, from around your hamstring to then go and rebuild it if there's not enough healthy tissue that's there. But I came out, didn't have any cuts anywhere else on me, so clearly didn't have to do that. And then, yeah, managed to hopefully, you know, put everything back together. But it's just a case of building all the strength through it. And it takes so long. The tendon's such a big tendon that requires such a large blood supply that it's literally just a case of time. You can't just hammer the rehab and hope that it gets quicker. Like, if you do too much, you're just going to break it again.
So there's no, at this point in time, the recovery is just recovery. There's no other sort of interventions you can do to help speed things along or increase X, Y, Z. It's just sit around.
Exactly. So I can obviously do cross training. I can exercise, like, I can work every other muscle apart from, like, things that directly impact my calf or my Achilles on my left leg. So there's more I can do than I can't. Obviously, the crucial thing I can't do is run. And then, unlike other injuries where you might be, you know, if someone's got a certain injury in April and they're thinking, well, the Olympic trials are in June, and you might be like, okay, I'm going to get an injection or I'm going to get something that might just give me a temporary fix to try and get me through. With this, you know, there's literally nothing that can help it go quicker than it is if you want to recover properly in the long term. So it's better just to mentally wipe out the summer, be like, is what it is. That is annoying, but it's done. And then hopefully if I'm back running walking September, October, whenever that is, as everyone else is kind of starting their winter type training, hopefully it'll be a nice smooth transition to gradually start doing stuff with the juniors down at the track at a slower pace, lower volume, and then just ease my way back into it. But fitness and stuff is not a concern. Like, I'm pretty sure I'll get my fitness back pretty quickly. It's literally a case of, like, whether my muscles and joints are going to be able to handle it, which is my concern, because I've never really had an injury of the, well, I've never had a serious injury at all, to be honest. So that's going to be the difficult part, I think.
Yeah.
Can you talk us through the current cross training a little bit? Is there a formulated plan behind it? Is it something you, like, come up with your coach, or has he just said, keep up the fitness? Or, yeah, what's your current approach to that?
Yeah, it's really basic. It kind of emulates running in a sense where I literally have just, like, an easy, at the moment I can't do elliptical and I can't swim either because I can't get it wet yet. So I can only do static bike at the moment, or, like, seated rowing machine or ski erg or something like that. Predominantly I'm on the bike, and every day I'll do between 45 minutes and an hour 15 easy, other than a Tuesday and a Thursday or a Tuesday and a Friday where I'll have my session, if you will. The Tuesday will be tempo focused. So I think I've got to do it this afternoon, actually. I think I'm up to 3 by 15 minutes, I think. So what's that, 45 minutes of tempo? So, like, I'm gradually getting it up. That literally started at, like, 2 times 5 minutes, and we've just worked up. And then the Thursday or Friday will be more of a VO2 max focus. So that's basically like 30 second reps or 60 second reps at a much higher heart rate. And I'm doing everything off a mix of my heart rate and just, like, perceived effort. Because, to be honest, like people say like, oh, you're going to come back so good, like you're going to be on the bike. But like what people don't realize is like the people that do that. So you see like Georgia Bell, Elliot Giles, like all these people that are notoriously like big cross trainers. And that's why they're such good runners. It's because they complement it alongside world-class running on the track. So like Elliot will smash cross training and be one of the best cross trainers in the world. But also he goes on the track, puts his spikes on, and he runs really hard and puts himself in the bin, you know? So it's not a case that I'm just going to put my shoes back on and be like, wow, I'm an aerobic monster now. Like everything's fine. You have to complement it with the running. So I'm not putting too much pressure on myself to like do a certain amount of hours or, you know, get a heart rate of this or do this power test or whatever. It's just like, keep my weight down, keep like a good body composition in terms of all the compound movements I can do, keep my muscles that I can look after in a decent spot. So then when I do get back running, I make it easy for myself rather than come back, you know, 6-7 kg heavier and have not done any sort of weights or anything, because it'll just be difficult to get back running.
One of the things I read about one of the worst mistakes about cross training when you're injured is coming back in too good of, like too fit, because when you come back in too good a shape, you start running too fast, too quickly, just because you're naturally in quite good shape and the mechanics and, you know, in your case, the tendon and the Achilles won't be ready to handle that load yet, but you'll feel like you can because you're in good shape. So I can't remember who it was. It was Jack Daniels, the coach. He was saying like, if he ever has athletes who are out injured, he wants them to come back not in great shape so that they can get the fitness back in running and build up in the proper way rather than come back and smash it straight away because it's too dangerous, basically.
Yeah, I'd agree, because I think like with most runners and like you guys, if you've been injured yourself, I'm sure you'll agree, like the discipline to do your rehab or to cross train isn't really an issue because you understand like what you're putting in, you're going to get out and you're trying to get back running. The actual difficulty is the discipline to not do too much, which is quite hard because it's like, okay, if he's given me 5 times 10 seconds of these like reps I've got to do in my rehab on my Achilles, the temptation for me to be like, well, I've got the time, why don't I just do 10 or smash out 8 reps or I'll double the sets because surely I'm gonna heal quicker if I do more rehab. That's like where your brain can slip to, but you have to trust the people that have given you the right experts and sort of the recommended like dose of rehab or dose of training they've given you. So I'm just trying to remind myself that I need to reserve some energy for recovery. Like my body can't be depleted every day because it needs to, you know, again, that science stuff needs to happen on my leg and then you got to get down there and get it fixed.
Yeah, exactly. Have you been injured, Gavin?
I might have had a couple of little niggles, isn't there? So Callum, just to clarify, this is all cross-training with a boot on at this stage?
Yeah, everything with a boot on. The only thing I can do without the boot is I don't have to sleep with it. I've got this like night splint that I can wear instead.
So, yeah, I mean, you're talking as if that's like just completely run of the mill and I'm just cross training because that's what I do and that's what an athlete does. Like, I'm not convinced that that's entire, like normal isn't the right word, but I think cross training in your situation, I think that is showing, yeah, I don't know, a certain level of commitment, but I think other people may also look at it as, you know, rightly or wrongly, they may think, is this worth it? Like at this point in time, when you've still got such a long road ahead, are you gaining enough for that to be worthwhile?
And to be honest, if I was from the outside, I'd probably say the same thing, where I'd be like, well, what does it do? Should you do it? Should you be doing X, Y, and Z? I'm just like, I committed at the start to the experts that I was referred to and the consultants that was like, British Athletics said, look, we've had these athletes that have done this Achilles thing before, or they've had similar issues. These are the two doctors we refer them to. Like, and they got back running within this amount of time, or they went on and went to 2 Olympics or whatever it was. So I'm just following the surgeon's guidelines of, he says, look, you can happily smash whatever you want on the bike within reason, like go to field, do whatever. So I'm kind of taking that as, yeah, I'll do it. I think it's good mentally because, you know, normally I'd pop out for a walk and be like, oh, just go and get fresh air for an hour. Like trying to walk around in that boot for an hour is just a nightmare. So like just from a mental perspective, doing a bit and stuff is good. And then it just like fits in with diet and everything. It's like I can continue just to eat whatever I want. I don't have to think about like, oh, I've not done exercise in ages. It's just easy. Get on, feel good for 45 minutes on the bike. I'm not killing myself. I'm not throwing up being like doing some lactic sessions. It's like pretty like standard. I enjoy exercise. I'm not thinking like, oh shit, I better do something or I have to do it. It's more from a perspective of, you know, I'm enjoying it to an extent. Don't get me wrong. Sometimes I'm like, ah, it's a bit shit today. Yeah, I'm just going to do 30 minutes rather than an hour. And I'm not then up all night thinking, shit, I did 30 minutes, not an hour. It's like, you know, it's not too deep in that sense.
Mm.
It looks pretty awkward to be on the bike with, to be honest.
Yeah, that's why I can't do too much though, because like that's what my physio said. He was like, if you do too much, your right leg's just going to, you're going to get back running. Your right leg's going to be massive relative to your left, because especially with the boot on, like I can push with the boot, but obviously I can't pull the pedal back up, right? So like my cycling like is so much, all the power's coming through my right leg rather than my left. So again, it's, you know, more of how's it impacting my heart and like cardiovascularly staying a bit fit and not worrying too much about what's happening with my legs. But then it does mean that things like leg extension in the gym or hamstring curls that I can do with my left leg, I have to just be disciplined to make sure that I keep them up. Otherwise, I'm going to get back running and cause myself so many injuries with imbalances and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think that's what Callum said about not coming back too fit. That's where that is going to be key, isn't it? Like you don't want to be fit enough that you can go, all right, I can run for 30 minutes, but your body's not ready for it in other ways.
Yeah, I think the ego's just got to go, right? Like the ego's completely got to go out the window with cross training and with running, where like, I'm sure there'll be some people that are looking at it going, oh, well, when I was injured, I did 14 hours a week and he's only doing 7. Like, shouldn't he be doing more, blah, blah, blah. I'm sure there is like people, and equally there'll be people going like, oh, I can't believe he's doing so much. Like, he should do way less. And when I get back running, I'm sure it'll be the same. Some people will go, bloody hell, he's never going to be back. He's doing, you know, 2 miles a week at 10 minute miling. Like, he's not running very fast. And equally, some people will probably say, I'm doing stuff too fast and too soon. I think you just got to trust what you're doing. And as long as you can support it with either evidence or the advice of people that know what they're talking about, and just not let your ego get too much and think you have to do a certain thing, or people are going to think this about you, or you've got to, you know, prove yourself to someone. You just got to trust your plan. And like I've always done, if it goes wrong and I do it incorrectly, then it's on me. Do you know what I mean? I'm not letting anyone else down. I've fucked it for myself, basically. But if I follow the advice and do what I think is right and trust that it's going to pay off, as long as I can justify that to myself, then it's fine.
Has it in any way affected, I don't know where you're at with Hoka, but sponsorship or potential sponsorship or anything like that?
No, Hoka are great. Like the thing about a brand is that I get the question quite a lot since I got injured. And like, if you think about it just from a purely like commercial point of view, if you're Hoka and you've like signed me for a couple of years on a contract, the second I get injured, especially because I'm an athlete that has a bit of an online presence, if I was dropped or like there were like some sort of excuse that no, we can't fulfill the contract just as soon as I got injured, and I voice that and say, oh, I've parted ways with Hoka because I got injured and they don't want me anymore, the likelihood of other athletes wanting to sign for the brand would be so it would be affected, right? Because you'd think, well, hang on a minute, that's a big risk, because if I get injured, they're going to boot me to the curb kind of thing. So yeah, they haven't, they're really supportive. Chris Rainsford, that's our athlete manager, he's actually really invested in the like content side of things, and how with the extra time that I've got and still wanting to be involved in athletics, how can I help them out with trying to create some content for other athletes, both in the UK and a couple in Europe as well, and how we can do that sort of thing. So if anything, you know, Chris was there when it actually happened, and he brought me the fresh pair of spikes that I wore for 2 laps and got sliced opening. So I think he bears some of the grief with me on that one. And yeah, they've been really supportive. So no, it's all good from the Hoka perspective. From other brands, obviously you're definitely affected, because like, you guys as well know, like when you do a good race or you do a good event, or like you're popular for that 5 minutes, that's when you know, from a business perspective, you're getting more engagement with people, brands are interested, you're kind of hot property, quote unquote. So for me, when I was running a PB this week and then representing GB, the other kind of like supplementary brands and the little ones on the side, of course, are interested in wanting to work with you. Now it's not that appealing, a guy that just sits on the bike and then talks about other people running. It's kind of lost its charm a little bit in terms of branded stuff. So I'm finding ways around it by creating content with other people and stuff like that. But yeah, my own kind of commercial side is obviously affected a little bit, but luckily it's not my main stream of income. So I don't have to stress too much.
Can we move on to that avenue a little bit, and perhaps again, to try not to just cover things that you've done 100 times before, maybe try to go down how the two sides, your running and then the sort of the online presence, how they've kind of gone hand in, or at least from the outside, they appear to have really gone hand in hand in terms of as one's developed and grown, the other's developed. And I don't bring this up to embarrass you, and I hope it doesn't, but just to kind of show how far you've come in quite a short space of time. If I flick back to the first time you and I ever connected, it was on Instagram, December, only 2.5 years ago. And you sent us a little message, just, it was after Matt Rees had been out in Kenya with us, and you sent us a little message, like basically saying, oh, if you ever want any content that will appeal to a younger audience, give me a shout. And I remember replying, like saying, yeah, cool, that's definitely something to sort of bear in mind. But at that point, you were very sort of new, you were very new to that side of things. And you were also nothing like the kind of caliber of athlete that you are now. And they've both, in my opinion, again, you correct anything that I've said that's not right. But in my opinion, they've both kind of accelerated really quickly in quite a short space of time. So I wonder if you can kind of take us through that journey a little bit. Whether I'm right in saying that they've kind of gone hand in hand, or if it's a bit more coincidence, or.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great example that you give in terms of, like, I think one thing that I've always been good at, or I think I'm good at, is being proactive with just trying to get stuff done, basically. And in terms of so like you said, oh, don't be embarrassed by it, whatever. I guess some people would kind of have that fear of like, oh, what if the person says no, or they ignore me, or they go, oh, he's only got 1,000 followers and he's an average runner in the UK, and kind of laugh you off type thing. But because I kind of believe in what I can produce from a value point of view, whether it's me representing a brand or being associated with someone, or it's kind of something I can actually deliver in terms of like a piece of content, then I think as long as you understand your own value, then it's fine to reach out to people. So like you said, at the time, of all the people you could reach out to, I'm not ticking the boxes you want, which is like, oh, we've got, you know, an audience of these type of people that are going to come here, or we want someone that's of this caliber, or whatever, which is totally fine. And there's probably loads of other people that I reached out to at the time from different brands that probably thought the same, who in hindsight now, if I message them, or they might even message me and say, do you want to do something, and,
yeah, sure,
and work together. And the yeah, best example I can give
now,
that
now
is...
Now it's going to cost us money rather than...
The best example I can give is with agents, I think, rather than brands, is the best. So when I came back from America in 2022, I wasn't in a position where I was ever going to be able to sign a pro contract. I run 3:40 for 1500 meters and, you know, 13:50 for 5K. I was like a good domestic club runner, and I'd be like, I'd, you know, do really well at that sort of thing. But from purely on ability wise, I wasn't good enough to sign a professional contract. But I reached out to some agents just because I wanted advice of like, how do I go about getting in quicker meets? Like, I'm at the level where I'll probably win a BMC. So like, I need to look outside the UK. I need to try and get my times down. And the amount of agents I reached out to saying like, hi, I'm just looking for some free advice. I'm not asking to, you know, you to get me a brand. I don't feel entitled for any kit. Like, just like, how should I approach this? Or can you like, is there anything you can do to try and help me with some races? Who should I email? That sort of thing. And as you can imagine, literally like nobody replied. I got a couple of like courtesy replies from people being like, oh, you know, great to hear that you're back from America. Like, sorry, we can't really be of help. Or got a couple saying like, sorry, I only want to work with people that are representing GB on a regular basis, whatever. And then you wouldn't believe, when I got that world silver medal in Riga in 2023, so a year later, my DMs, when I went onto the messages, I'd open them and someone had sent me a really nice message. And this is no slight on anyone, because if I was them, I'd do the same thing. It's like how the world works. But I'd go on and see their message, and I'd scroll up the chat and I'd go, hang on a minute, 2022, I reached out to you and I said a really nice, like, oh yeah, yeah, I really like this, and was really complimentary. You've seen it and not even replied. And then now it's, you want a piece of the pie. It's like, do you know what I mean? So maybe that's just the way the world is with stuff like that. But you're definitely right that with the content and the running side of things, they do go hand in hand. And I think if you just want to build your reputation, your name from running, then you've got to be really good. You've got to let all the times and the achievements on the track have to be very, very good. You have to be walking onto GB teams and winning world medals and getting PBs and being in diamond leagues. If you're doing that, you don't need an Instagram or a social media. You'll clean up on your prize money. You'll get good bonuses. You'll get a good contract. And if you don't care about people knowing your name and stuff, then it's fine. You're a good enough runner. I recognized very early on I wasn't of that caliber, and I probably never will be at the caliber where I'll just be like my running can just do the talking for itself. I needed something like a backup, if you will, or something else that was going to set me apart from other guys that had run 3:40 or 3:39 or whatever. So when a German race director is deciding who's going to be the 10th guy on the list, and he's got three of us, but I've said, oh, by the way, I'm going to film it and make like a free video. The race is going to look really good. It's free promotion. Then I might be the one that gets picked. And I always saw that that was a possibility. And I knew that if I then went to those races and I performed well, it would slightly open a next door. And in that summer, I think I went down from kind of 39, 38, 37, 36. Like I pretty much got a PB in every race and then ended up at 335, where now, of course, I don't need to say to a race director, I'm going to make a video because I've run 335. So now my PB does the talking for me. But without all that other stuff, it wouldn't have been the case.
So are you self-funding that? Are you paying to have that content produced?
Yeah. So when we initially started, it was a mixture of, I was with Saw Running at the time. So I basically pitched the idea to Rob Wilson, who's a great guy from Saw. And I just said, look, I've got this idea where I think I'm in this sub elite category. I'm not professional, but I'm not just like a hobby jogger. I think is something unique, like that I can show about my kind of like hustle to get into these races. I can produce some videos. Can you give us like a small budget to contribute towards the travel? They were really sound about it and just said, look, we can give you some money that's going to help you get your flights to do this race, get a bit of accommodation, whatever. We're never going to make any profit from it, but we just needed a bit of a helping hand. And then with a lot of the races, they would also contribute either a budget towards the travel and or offer free accommodation. So that helped plug the gap quite a little bit. But yeah, the majority of the cost was fronted by myself to say, you know, let's go and do it. And then luckily, Charlie McCarthy that I work with, he was really looking to build his portfolio. So I just said to Charlie, I said, I can't pay you. You're not going to make any profit from it, but like it won't cost you anything. So like I can cover all your costs. If you want to come out and like film these things, it's a cool opportunity, like to build a portfolio, you know, it'd be great to have you there. We get along as mates. And he was at a point in his career/life where he could do that. So luckily it was a perfect storm, because if I had to then pay for a videographer and all their time editing and someone of Charlie's caliber, it would have been a big, much bigger financial risk from that perspective. So yeah, a mixture of luck, and in hindsight looks like a great strategy and a plan that we had, but a lot of it is just like fortune, and it's just a good job that I ran well. Cause if I'd run shit in those races, the videos wouldn't have gone down well. I wouldn't have progressed in my career, and I wouldn't have a contract to say, oh, it's all right, because it's all paid off, because now I'm getting a salary from Hoka. Like I would have just been like, shit, just wasted loads of money on running abroad.
Well, I mean, would it have been wasted, or has it opened other doors, and can you actually directly make money through that now? Like, are you at that level where it can?
Yeah, we can make money through that level. And like, we'd obviously do brand endorsements and things like that. But again, we have less pressure to do so. Like, I'm sure you guys, like me, right? Like 2 years ago, emailing you saying like, can I do this, fishing around for something free? Like we get the exact same things where people approach us with a brand and they want to do a YouTube ad or whatever. And you're just like, well, I don't really want to stoop to that level, but like, I'm in a fortunate enough position where I don't need to just take every single brand thing. Right. So of course we could make money, but I think the position I would be in, and maybe the audience I want to cater to, which is people like yourself and your audience, where you're really keen runners, you maybe you're part of a club, you understand running, you're less of like a, you know, that new run culture we're seeing, you know, like download runner app and do this and do that type thing. You're the people I want respect from, to be like, fair enough to that guy. Like, yeah, he does things a bit differently, but like he actually does his talking on the track and like competes at a good level, rather than going down the full influencer route of being like, I somehow need to fund this, so I better just endorse this and endorse that and get 20% off here and do whatever. So I'm just trying to find a balance between the two.
Yeah, sure.
Is that the app you use to generate your program, Gavin?
Say again? Runner app.
Is that the app that you use to generate your program?
Yeah, it's quite funny. It's, I'm not sure we've got time to go into it.
Go on.
in a nutshell, my sister-in-law uses it, and she's the right person to be using it, and it's great. I can't knock it. Like, she was training, you know, a couple of times a year she picks a race and she enters it and she goes and does a half marathon or whatever. And we were just around the kitchen table and she was showing it to me, and I was looking at it, I was thinking, yeah, okay, fair enough, I can see that looks sensible advice. And I was like, all right, okay, so how does it work? She's like, oh, you just tell them what your goal date race is and what your target time is, and you tell them what your current shape is, and it just generates this program for you. I was like, all right, okay, yeah, let's give it a go. So I was like, okay, so I'm currently in 31 minute shape, and in 12 weeks time, I want to try and run a marathon. I thought, let's be really ambitious. Let's see if it thinks I can run a 2:15 marathon in 12 weeks' time. Not only did it think I could run it, it thought I could run it off significantly reduced training from what I was currently doing. As long as I did 15 by a K in 2:45 on the Tuesday, within the next couple of weeks, and some pretty substantial long runs, again, with no base mileage at all, just go out and start hitting 30 Ks at 3:25 per K.
Yeah.
So yes, somewhere along the line, it loses its way and it goes from being really quite sensible to, utter nonsense.
100%. And I think that for me, that's the only thing, like, nothing against the people that have built it. And I've actually got an old friend from school that works for the company now. And I'm sure they're all great people. And like you said, there's a demographic where it is really valuable. The only thing that I just dislike is just some of the marketing plays around, like, be coached by an Olympian type vibe. I think using lines like that, because I don't know if the professional runners that are providing some of the training or have their name, I don't know if they know that that's the advertising that's going on. But like you said, I don't think those athletes would set you 15 by a K in 2:45. Do you see what I mean? So it's kind of, it's on there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's kind of on there. Yeah, it's utterly ludicrous. And there was a little soundbite from said athlete explaining to me why I should be doing it. which clearly she wouldn't actually set me that in real life.
And that's nothing against that individual. I think that's just where there's maybe some oversight and you just think like, again, so, I like to weigh up my financial reward to what am I actually like.
I would agree with that. And I think that's a good, I think that's one, that's a good position you've been in. And then two, it's good that you can maintain your authenticity by not sort of selling out to that route. But then the specific bit of marketing that I didn't like about it, and it was just a clip of a podcast. So I would say, given the benefit of the doubt, it could be out of context, but it'd be difficult for this to be out of context. So it was the founder basically making the claim that this app is perfect for every runner. And then he made it very clear that that includes elite athletes. He's like, this is perfect for everyone from beginners all the way through to your elite runners. This works for you. And I was thinking... Well, I know it doesn't, because if you're telling me as a 31-minute guy to go and run a session that, frankly, the guys who won London Marathon would be pretty happy with, what are you going to be telling them to do? What would it set Emil Caress? What would Emil Caress be doing on Tuesday night if he's if I'm doing 15 by K at 2:45?
It's that classic thing. I think there's a broader conversation with, like, you know, the good thing about the app, I guess, is I can't remember exactly how much they charge. But there's some online coaches, I use that term lightly, where they probably charge 10 times the price and provide the same level of training, honestly, because it's all just about. So, you know, at least they're not coming in with a nuts price point is what I will say. So even if some of the training is a bit off, like, it's good that, you know, there's bigger cowboys out there of people that will tell you, like, this is what you're doing.
For the people it should be targeted at, which probably is still 90% of their actual market, it's really very good. And it is quite a reasonable price, I think. Lauren's Sisters pays about 12 to 15 pounds a month. Got pretty solid, sensible advice that she wouldn't otherwise know.
The thing is that we're in the running world, aren't we? So, like, the sources we have to go off and the things that we see, or like, I always try and take myself out of my own Instagram timeline, where, like, the algorithm's serving me stuff. I can't just assume that everyone else sees the same stuff I do. So I look at the app or whatever, and I'm like, well, why? Like, all the free information's here. You can see what elite athletes are doing. You can see Strava. You can see all these sessions. Like, you could easily build your own training plan, just even if you don't know much about running. But then I think about other people's timeline, or, like, I go on my girlfriend's phone and it's like, no, it's just me that sees all this running shit, you know?
Yeah.
Like, she's seen food and then this and then the holiday pictures and whatever. It's like, it's not normal that people do just have all that content to consume. So if you don't know anything about running and you just want some guidance and it's half the price of your gym membership, then... yeah, I think it's great. But this is not a sponsored podcast, by the way, if anyone's just tuning in.
This is an anti-sponsored podcast. We're never getting a sponsor. We're certainly not getting sponsored by Runner anytime soon, are we?
It's brand recognition. We're giving them the limelight, though.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's one of those. There's a word for that where you sort of pretend you're being anti something, but just to drive attention to it. I don't know what it is.
There we go.
I was going to say, Not necessarily to wrap up immediately, but to wrap up in the next couple of minutes, if you can give us a little bit of what's next, because to some extent we know what's next, but kind of like, what are your do you have any particular sort of milestones, or is it literally you have to take it day by day? And and then perhaps slightly
I had a slightly broader question, but it might take longer than 10 minutes, but maybe see what you think. But we spoke a lot about the injury, and I think, you know, you would have been someone we definitely wanted to get on the podcast, even if you hadn't been injured, and we would like to have heard your story about, you know, where you were going and what your goals are and what your ambitions are. And you said in this podcast that you maybe don't think that you're going to be ever someone of the caliber of, you know, the top GB athletes who walk onto a GB team, but your trajectory would potentially say otherwise. So could you maybe tell us a little bit about, I guess, how you see yourself coming off the injury? Maybe you said summer's kind of written off, but looking into the winter and maybe even next summer, what are your plans? What are your goals? What are your ambitions? Big question, yeah. I guess.
No, definitely. It is an interesting one, because I think I'm trying to find a balance mentally between being super motivated, aspirational, like, you know, visualizing like being back on the track and getting back in a GB vest and doing racing. But equally, I'm trying to almost look at myself objectively and be like, okay, if you were giving advice to someone else in your situation, would you pile the pressure on them saying like, oh, you want to qualify for this Euros or this World Champs? You'd say no. Like, it might take you a little bit of time. You've got to be patient and not expect a result to come straight away. So I really have no idea what, you know, shape I'll be in when I get back and what those goals will be. Next year, obviously, there is various championships. There's European indoors, which I don't know what the qualification times will be or what the window is. But, you know, if it's a year and a bit window, maybe I might already have the time. It might be something I go and look for. And then in the summer, there's obviously the outdoor world champs. And in the same way that I'm injured and I'll be out of the picture this summer and I'm not someone that people need to worry about, I'm sure next year other people will have their own mishaps and injuries and things like that. So it's not a case that I'll just be at the bottom of the ladder and have to work my way up necessarily again. I hope I can get back into a decent bit of shape. That could be good. One thing that I do think is going to be really beneficial is what I said about like Giles and Georgia Bell and stuff with the cross training, because I'm going to have 9 months now or 6 months till I'm running where I'm going to get so used to cross training that I can't really see that being totally eliminated at any point. And it's going to take me so long till I'm back up to 80, 90 miles a week or whatever I want to run, that I'm going to have to continue cross training and smarten up of how to train, get on the elliptical, how to swim, stuff like that. So if when I do return to running properly and training, if I can find a really nice structure of actually I'm doing 25-50% more aerobic stuff than I was when I was training before, I might actually become a way better athlete than I was previously. And there is positives to be taken from the fact that if I've been doing 10 hours a week on the bike, and then when I'm running, I only have to do 3 or 4 and it feels quite nice, then I definitely think I can get up to a decent level. But yeah, I mean, you will see this summer, if I was ranked 6th or 7th 1500 meter guy, there's going to be people that will come through just like I did this summer. And you'll see some guys that are 339 make that big jump to 334, 335. Mm-hmm. So I'll probably be arriving next year, maybe 10th, 11th name on the list in terms of where I am on a season's best or whatever. And it'll be up to me and how other people perform to see, you know, how high I can jump up those lists and where I can race and where I get back to. But yeah, the goal is definitely... Go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say, it's one of the strongest times I can remember. Like, you know, you have to go back to like almost the glory days for it to be this good top end and depth.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I think what I would say though is we've got Kerr's, obviously Josh has proven he can race, and like Jake's proven that he can race. With a lot of other people, when they're at the bridge, I would say, between they can run the times, it's fantastic, and we can make championships. But then the performance at the championships, or how they handle rounds, or how they do that at British Champs, is obviously where there's like the big jump needs to be made. In the same way that I'm a level below that before I was injured, now I need to make the jump to run the qualifying times. They've ticked that box. They now need to push on to see how we can race. So I think based on PBs, we could have like, you know, if you were allowed to take unlimited people based on PBs, we could probably have 4 or 5 British guys in a 1500 final. If you think about your Stonias, your Giles, your Mills, etc. But how they negotiate rounds, both at British Champs, and find a way to get in that top two. And then if they do qualify, how they then get through heat semifinals, stuff like that. I think that's the next level of learning that we have in training. Everyone's figured out how to run fast. It's now, how do you run fast 3 days in a row, basically?
Yes.
Which, unless you can do 140 miles a week, I don't really know how else you work it out. But someone's going to crack it, and I'm sure it'll trickle down in some sort of double threshold style way, and we'll find out.
It's going to be triple threshold. That's going to be the next frontier. Yeah. Let's not go down that route.
My big goal for next year is just I think it'd be really good if I could represent GB again. I don't know whether that would be indoor, outdoor, cross country, whatever, but I think that would be really good to keep kind of my streak of representing GB going, and also as a nice thing to work towards, to be like in some capacity, pick out one target event. There's the Road Championships again, which obviously I did well in. So just different things, and pick one and say, right, let's just try and get back for that. And they're spaced apart enough that if my recovery is slower than I think it's going to be, I can just look ahead to the next one. Because across the year, there's kind of indoors, outdoors, then the Road Champs, then European Cross. So there's like all across the year, there's chances to qualify and do things. So depending on how I recover, I'll pick one of those out and then just try and go for that.
Sweet. Sounds good. Nice. Well, we will continue to follow along. On the off chance that there's someone listening who isn't already, where can other people follow that journey?
Yeah, the Distance Project on Instagram. I'm sure if you just search that, it comes up. Or to be honest, like the YouTube videos, I think is far more enjoyable than just seeing the random stuff that I post. Especially because we're starting to make videos about other people. So we've got some good content with Becky Briggs that's come out as we speak. And then by the time this podcast is out and stuff, we'll have some stuff live with the Hoka, some UK Hoka athletes, Rory Leonard, Scott Beattie, sweet, Ellis Cross. All coached by Andy Badley, who, if you don't, Andy Badley, coached by Andy Hobdell, who did coach Andy Badley, Hobdell, who is such a maverick, but like such a lovely guy as well. We've got a cool 3-part video series with them coming out in the build up tonight at the 10Ks. So if you enjoy elite athletics, that's probably what I would recommend
I think I'm racing that lot next week or this week on Friday.
Oh, Comeback 5000.
Yeah.
There you go, mate. Well, I'm rooting for you, honestly. That would be a great start to the video if you beat them.
My plan's to go off at 13:20 pace with them and just see how long I can hold on for, and then finish in 16:40.
Yeah, I mean, if you go through 3K, you might get a PB, and then from there it's a win anyway, isn't it? That'll be my PB as well. But yeah, they're running 64s, I think. So if the weather's good, and I'm sure one of them or two of them will do it, but there's going to be some fatalities, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's my hope is that there are a few, and I'm just going to tag along at the back, and anyone who's gone off like a madman, I'm just gonna clean up as we come through, but we'll see.
Yeah, well, I'll see you there. I'll probably come down. Is it Saturday or Friday?
Friday.
I'll probably come down. So that sounds good.
Nice.
Right. Cool. Good stuff. Callum, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate that.
Pleasure, boys. Thank you very much, lads.
Cheers, lads. Cheers. Great stuff.
Thanks for listening to Conversations About Running, the podcast by Running Trips. If you enjoyed today's episode with Callum Elson, please consider leaving us a review and sharing with other runners. To find out more about Running Trips, the team behind Conversations About Running, you can head to our website, www.runningtrips.co.uk, or follow us on Instagram at running_trips_official. Join us again next time for another episode, and in the meantime, happy running.